years. There's no look, there's no prospect of it ending anytime soon. So those people who say, well, you should just keep them close at hand, are basically saying these people should be kept in suspended animation. Their lives should stop. Children should cease being children and growing up until, you know, this goes. And I think you're right. You know, the idea of the West taking on more, we have the capacity, we have the resources, and I've mentioned previously on a show that it tends to be very much a win-win situation. You know, European population is aging. They need a new infusion of youth to help pay for their social services.
Yeah.
But what about the other argument I've heard about that countries like, well, basically the Arabian Peninsula, all of the Emirates, Saudi Arabia and all that, have taken in zero refugees. And get me wrong, they have claimed that they have given up about $500 million in support for the refugees in other nations. But when you figure in the United States, which granted is rich, has spent, I think, about $41 billion. They built something like the world's tallest building for like $40 billion. And all they're offering is like $500 million and taking in nobody?
Yeah. I was actually watching this news clip, and it is by Fox News, so brace yourself. They were saying that America was sort of hesitant to take in these refugees because they sort of fear ISIS members being among these Syrian refugees. And I was just sort of like, really? Like, that's, you know, a lot of these are children, and that's really what you're focusing on?
Well, they're parroting the concurrent leader of this nation who has similar reservations.
Yeah. And, you know, I just thought it was, you know, Islamophobia, sort of. You know, they are from the Middle East. They are Arab, so they have that negative stigma on them. And then with the whole ISIS threat going on, I don't really think that justifies how they're responding. But then I also thought about all those other, you know, Arab nations that are nearby that are Muslim countries, you know, that don't have that same prejudice, yet are still taking in no one. So I'm not 100% sure. I think it's really messed up.
I know there's two angles to go here. I'm going to finish up with one thought, with the security risks. Because most people give ISIS to have about maybe, you know, 30, 50,000 troops or something like that, right?
Yeah.
And if you think, you know, let's say all of them left Iraq and Syria and said, we're going to try and sneak into Europe to be, you know, the fifth column. That we're going to be the fifth column. Well, one, what are the odds that they're actually going to get through? Because, I mean, we've seen the resistance going through there.
Yeah.
And even if they get through, what are the odds they're going to end up in any place that they kind of plan to, let alone be able to do anything harsh? I mean, it's a ridiculous idea that these people are a genuine security risk. And the flip side to that argument is, even if, heaven forbid, worst case scenario, someone comes in and there is something like, I don't know, Charlie Hebdo or something, right? And 20 or 100 people get killed, which would be horrible.
Yeah,
but how many thousands are dying in the Mediterranean and on their way into Europe that wouldn't have to die if they just let them all in?
Yeah, and that's definitely very true. And I think, you know, a lot of the smugglers are actually benefiting greatly from Europe's resistance to the crisis situation. They're benefiting off the desperation of the people, of how badly they want to escape and have a better life. And there are a lot of, you know, parents that can't afford or don't have the money for the whole family to get on the boat. They'll put their kids on the boat, even though that's not even the safest, but it's not the safest option, but it's really the only option they see. And then the UN was sort of talking about how they need to crack down on the smugglers, when really Europe sort of opening their doors would be the greatest way to do that, I feel.
It's funny, because I remember watching one of the clips about the Syrians, and they had a mother sit there and say, listen, I know there's a good chance or a strong possibility that my child might die if I try and send them to Europe, but I know they're definitely going to die if they stay here. And that's that kind of desperate choice that is horrific. But there's another aspect going back to the Saudi Arabia, and I'm not sure, maybe you don't know this or not, but a lot of the Arab Emirates have their economic foundation is on immigrant labor. So the actual number of sort of Saudis in Saudi Arabia is like a fraction of the total population. And a lot of them come from like the Philippines and India and all that. And I wonder if part of what's going into, I mean, they claim they're worried about instability and, you know, terrorist threats as well. But, and this is where I'm going to play the religion card, is in their own minds, it's okay for them to discriminate and treat non-Muslims as sort of slave labor. Because there's lots of talk about how people who are building the football stadiums in Kuwait and all that are just, Qatar, are just being treated horrifically. But if they allowed these refugees in, they couldn't treat them as badly, at least maintaining their faith, because they are fellow Muslims. Or maybe I'm nuts on that.
Oh, no, that is true. In the, you know, sort of in that, in the religion, that is a strong belief that you cannot do that, you know, for people who are in that religion, they're seen as brothers and sisters, and you can't really treat each other that way. Of course, you know, what that belief is found on, you shouldn't treat other human beings that way as well. You should probably take that one step further. But yeah, I think that's unfortunate that that's the case. And I think that should be applied to other people as well, even if they don't share the same beliefs as you.
I think this ties back into another thing when we were talking about how the only people really benefiting or prospering from this are the people smugglers. And someone had come up, and I can't remember where I heard this from, but they had mentioned that, well, first of all, we should go back. Refugees have a very strong legal status in the world. There's UN conventions on what happens to a refugee once it enters your country. So once someone comes into Canada and they claim refugee status, there is a whole bunch of legal protections that pop into place. And, you know, you have to take them, they have to sort of have a trial, and they have to, you know, you can't just send them home like you would with migrant workers. And this has a very sort of weird effect in Europe, and one of the reasons why the European Union adopted this policy that you can apply for refugee status in the country you arrive in, i.e. Greece, Italy, or Spain, but you can't apply anywhere else. And the reason is if someone does get to Germany and say, hey, I'm a refugee, then Germany can't just kick them out. Germany has to take responsibility for them. So in a very perverse way, most of Europe wants the drug smuggling to fail, that they want these people to sort of not make it, because as long as they end up, actually maybe I got that wrong.
No, that's I've read a similar statements as well. They want to make it as hard as possible for the refugees to come on over, because once they're actually there, they have to sort of be accountable and take responsibility and not just ship them back.
And that is a crime against humanity.
It is, definitely. You know, again, you criticizing Europe, you know, us as, you know, Canadians and North America in general, well, U.S. and Canada, we're not doing too much better. But there is a lot that all of us collectively can do.
Yes. I think on that note, we'll call the segment to an end.
Okay.
I knew I had a problem.
I tried counting calories, eating and eating.
Nobody else could possibly understand.
We understand. We're Overeaters Anonymous, and we have helped thousands of people stop their compulsive eating and start living a healthy, rewarding life.
With OA, I am living again and loving it.
Start living the life you deserve with help from Overeaters Anonymous. Find us on the web at OA.org.
Hello and welcome back. A Sense of Science, a regular segment where we explore and explain some of the basics of science that we all know, or do we? This week, what's up with magnets? Insane Clown Posse lived up to their name by asking, feckin' magnets, how do they work? And well, on one level, that sounds like a silly question. And don't get me wrong, the posse are, how shall we say, intellectually challenged, but their question is not as silly as some of us, perhaps ivory tower types, might think. I had an interesting conversation with, quote, an open-minded individual. A little too open, I discovered, as the conversation persisted. But one topic that came up was perpetual motion machines. And he knows that they exist, because he saw them working on YouTube. And even if those weren't 100%, they were based on magnets. And, well, magnets are, the magnetic forever. So there had to be something there. My first thoughts, and much to my credit, not my first words, were, come on, fella, don't you know about conservation of energy? You can't get something for nothing. But those videos are either charlatans or idiots. As I said, first thoughts. But then I thought a second time, a good habit to get into, and realized I knew a platitude, but not the actual answer. What was the question? Where do magnets get the energy to keep themselves magnetic? Now, a number of my loyal listeners to Radio Freethinker just harumphed, a gasp, or a chuckle. The answer is basic, but not, I think, obvious. Obviously, I had to think about it. First, what is magnetism? We need to understand that natural magnetism is a result of atoms lining up. No, before we go there, let's get a little quantum. Electrons are one of the rare cases where quantum effects can be seen on the macro scale. You see, electrons have fundamental properties like mass and charge. They also have a property called intrinsic magnetic moment. But I think of this as little tiny bar magnets. Why bar magnets? Well, it's just a fundamental quality. It's like asking me, why does it have a charge? Who knows? Well, perhaps a theoretical physicist might have an idea. But to you and me, it's an electron. Each has its magnetic quality that I'm going to call barness. Now, every electron has a positive or southern side and a negative or northern side, bar magnet orientation. Now, each atom has a number of electrons orbiting them, and it is these electrons that give objects their natural magnetic charge, which is not really charge, but again, an intrinsic value. That's important later on. A little side note. Protons, which are also charged particles, also have barness, but their strength is orders of magnitude smaller than that of an electron. So they don't really count. Why smaller? Science! Okay, moving on. Now you might know that moving magnetic fields generate a current, which in turn generates a magnetic field. So if you have a bunch of electrons, each really tiny bar magnets, whipping around the nucleus of an atom, well, they should generate a current or electrical field, and they do. But thanks again to the quantum nature of electrons, these fields cancel each other out. Of course, this assumes that every electron has a partner, a countervailing body to cancel out with. But in atoms that do not have full shells, shells in this case are levels of an atom that have a full and usually neutral complement of electrons, but for an element with a half-filled shell, all the electrons lack a partner, so there's no cancellation, and the atom gains a magnetic field, i.e. the atom itself gains barness and becomes a little tiny bar magnet. Okay, so those of you who just rushed to your periodical table to find out what elements are magnetic might now be asking, well, if that's true, why is chromium not magnetic, when it has a similar shell structure to copper or molybdenum? In fact, chromium is classified as an antiferromagnet. What's up with that? Well, this is where quantum meets macro, or the real world. Even though each atom has barness, the metal, i.e. a large grouping of the elements, does not because of how the metal forms. This is where we move from atoms to crystals. Metals have a structure. We call this structure its crystalline form. Now metals, well, nature itself is a lazy ass. By that I mean, when an atom forms, it chooses a crystal structure that requires the least amount of effort or energy. So some elements, when they form crystals or metals, it's usually metals but not always, when they form the crystalline structure, think of it as like putting together a bookshelf from IKEA. Sometimes the barness aligns and you get a magnetic or ferromagnetic material, or they cancel each other out, anti-ferromagnetic material. The term ferro comes from iron, or its classical Latin name, ferrium, which is the most magnetic metal in nature. Okay, but again, I can hear some listeners yelling into their speakers the words, cast iron is not magnetic, it's made of iron, what's up with that? Well, as you may have noted, we're moving up in scale. The metals are not the end point. Cast iron and other composite objects are not strictly speaking one thing. Cast iron, for example, is made up of iron, but not the same iron all over. Okay, what the hell am I talking about? Let's start the idea with a lump of iron is magnetic. But we put a bunch of lumps of iron into a pot. We melt them and cast, see that cast, as in tossed at random, into a pot mold. That pot is not a single lump of iron, but an amalgam of iron bits. Each of those bits may be magnetic, be it up or down or left or right facing. But the one next to it may be in an opposite or different alignment. And remember that magnetism depends on barness of all its component parts pointing in the same direction. In the case of cast iron, the bits are pointing randomly. Or, like with the quantum atom, the barness value cancels out and the object as a whole is no longer magnetic, even though all its parts are. Weird or what? Caveat: random does not mean they cannot align. Just it's unlikely. So even cast iron could be magnetic, if only slightly. Second caveat: magnets, even on the atomic scale, can be moved if not changed. As I said, usually the field, so let's change our term of barness to magnetic field, well, these fields are not unchanging. If you heat a metal to a certain temperature, the atoms and the crystal can align to an external field orientation. This is what happens when magma from a volcano cools. It will take on the orientation of the planetary magnetic field. This provided some of the strongest evidence for continental drift. How? Well, taking readings of the magnetic orientations of the Atlantic Ocean floor, it was observed that there were bands of orientation. That is, a band may be pointing to magnetic north, others to magnetic south. When it was realized that the Earth's magnetic poles reversed over time, this correlated to the bands. That is, as magma erupted over time, it had a barness equal to the poles of the time. This provided a timeline of the expansion of the Atlantic and thus proving plate tectonics. Okay, so how does this relate to perpetual motion machines? Well, to understand that, we need to understand unnatural or electrically induced magnetism. So far, we've been talking about properties innate in material. Natural magnets are magnetic in the same way that a kilo of sugar is a kilo. It's a property of the universe. But not all magnetic fields are natural. Almost 200 years ago, Michael Faraday discovered that magnetism and electricity were essentially two sides of the same coin. That is, magnets could generate electric current, and electric current could induce magnetic fields. Science for the win! That said, the type of magnetism from what we've been talking about are really very different. So far we've been talking about innate magnetism, quantum effects writ large. And on a technical level, electromagnetism is the same, but in a real-world way, it's very different. Remember that natural magnetism was ultimately based on the fundamental property of electrons. You may also be realizing that electricity is the flow of electrons. We have a connection of sorts between electricity and magnetism. As electrons travel through a wire, they induce a magnetic field just like they do in atoms, metals, and crystals. But unlike those types, current is not an object, but an action. That is, electrons moving through something as opposed to just being part of something. Now, I should mention to the nerdier listeners, complimentarily speaking, electromagnetism is actually a result of relativity. But for now, it's magic. Well, not really, but this is the Magnetism for Dummies edition. So remember when we said that crystal structures that aligned the barness of electrons created a magnetic field? Well, electrons traveling through a wire does sort of the same thing. In this way, we can create a magnetic field out of essentially nothing. But there is a cost, and that's energy. Unlike natural magnets, those energy costs were paid in their formation. Electromagnetic energy needs some form of external power supply. It's the flow of electrons that create the current, which creates a magnetic field. Faraday also understood the opposite was true, that if you rotated a magnetic field through an electric wiring, it could induce an electrical current. Ah, you might say, so magnetic fields are energy, and that a permanent magnet should be able to provide permanent energy. Alas, no. The first law of thermodynamics, the law of conservation of energy, states that in a closed system, energy cannot be created or destroyed, but only transformed. Here we turn to my friend who believed in the perpetual motion machine. This law would have one of two consequences. Either a perpetual motion team would need an external source of power, i.e. it's not a closed system, or it would require energy being transformed. One could think of the atom bomb, where matter is transformed into energy. But the atom bomb is not perpetual. And a perpetual motion machine that requires external power is no different than a battery-powered motion machine. At this point, you might be saying, but if magnets are permanent and they can create electricity, is that not perpetual motion? Alas, again, no. The fault in logic is the closed system. You see, magnets do not induce electrical current. It is the kinetic energy. It is the rotation of the magnet that creates, or more appropriately, transforms kinetic energy into electrical energy. Let me put it this way. Now keep in mind, these are not the same on one level, but it does help demonstrate the idea. We're all subject to gravity, the force that pulls us towards the center of Earth. Okay, for the moment, let's say it's an object, a block of wood, for instance, falling towards the floor. When the block is on the table, it still has gravity, mass, but it's inert. It's not moving. There is no action, no work has taken place. Mass is just a property of the block. Now, if I lift the block off the table and then let it go, the block becomes active. There is momentum as it drops towards the floor. Work has been done, energy released. And we can honestly say that gravity produced that energy. But the source of the energy was not gravity itself. It was the transference of the mechanical or kinetic energy of my arm lifting the block up. If we did the math, the energy required to lift the block was equivalent to the energy released in dropping it. And a little less. No reaction is perfect. Now gravity is, from a fundamental force way, a good analogy to understand magnetism. But I still think one could argue, well, gravity powers the sun, indirectly. So yes, perpetual motion machines are real, or at least possible. And again, no. So let's go at this another way. Let's pretend that water is magnetism. And you have a pot of water sitting on the stove with the lid on. That is your bar magnet. It's just there. But wonders can occur when energy is applied. If we turn on a burner, the thermal energy of the stove will induce into the water, with the water becoming steam, and the steam raises the lid. We see that all the time. If we think of water as merely a fundamental force that transfers the thermal energy of the burner into the kinetic energy that lifted the pot lid, when we stop applying the heat, the motion ceases, there is no energy, and the lid settles down. But the water still remains. Even though it induced energy, that induction was simply moving one kind of energy to another. To close the analogy, using one of those hand-cranked emergency radio, the kind so handy when the power goes out, when the crank is turned, that's like the burner on the stove. You are simply supplying kinetic energy. As the water moves around, so does the bar magnet in the radio. In the way that water transformed the heat into lift, i.e. lifting the lid, so does the magnet transform kinetic energy into induced electrical energy. As long as you're cranking, the magnet will do the conversion. And when you stop inputting energy, the magnet has none of its own. So the flow of electricity stops. So we now see, and I must admit, it took me a bit of research to actually understand the technicalities of what I actually knew academically. Knowing something like the laws of thermodynamics is one thing, but seeing them in the real world, that can be wonderful. And at times a little uncomfortable. That's all the time we have for this segment. We'll be right back with Cryptic Corner.
Stephen Harper's reckless cuts to home mail delivery are hurting the most vulnerable in our society. Senior citizens and those with mobility issues are disproportionately affected by these cuts, all while Canada Post is making millions of dollars in profit. Postal workers are campaigning to protect quality jobs and public services in our communities. The post office belongs to you. Join the fight today at SaveCanadaPost.ca.
And we're back. So this is the first edition of Cryptid Corner. I'll start with, what is a cryptid? It's an animal or plant whose existence has been suggested but has not been discovered or documented by the scientific community. And a cryptid corner Well, that's when we use the portion of Radio Freethinker as an opportunity to discuss that as yet mythical unconfirmed creature and delve into what the creature is and its supposed habitat. We'll then view that information with a skeptical eye and dissect the evidence said cryptid exists, what its investigations have been done, and the current plausibility said creature actually exists. Now, this is not a let's make fun of stupid people's beliefs discussion. That I say for my comments on religion. No, this is not as delusional in that there have been a number of fantastical creatures that have actually proven to be real. The mountain gorilla, the platypus, and others. Now, I was going to start the series with Bigfoot, with the aim of enlightening those who may actually believe this creature exists. But having said that, this is not intended to be a hatchet job. I will save that for perhaps future episodes. Now, this week, we'll start with an explanation of what really qualifies as a cryptid. For this definition, I'm going to be generous and use Fringe Science's own definition. This is from the Journal of Scientific Exploration, a magazine set up in the 80s by those investigators who wished to establish a forum for three main fields that have been largely neglected by mainstream science: UFOlogy, cryptozoology, and parapsychology. Okay, Fringe might be a bit generous. When talking about Rome, one should at least talk to a Roman. At least once. So accordingly, to this source, there are about 10 categories of cryptids as such, with 6 criteria that would disqualify one incidentally, if that's the right word, that could be a real cryptid. First off the post are distributional anomalies. That would be like an elephant on the prairies. Basically a known type of animal found outside its expected habitat. Let's call these misplaced species. Not a cryptid because the animal actually exists, but not where it should be. Of course, they could be reclassified in the next category should more information be discovered. The second would be undescribed, unusual, or outsized variation of a known species. These are basically a known species, but with some unusual characteristic, like a wolf the size of a bear. It still has the characteristics of a wolf in every way but size. I'm calling these anomalous cryptids. These are like known species, but are not actually that species, thus cryptid instead of species. The third classification would be the survival of a recently extinct species. This is a creature assumed to be extinct, but may not be. There's been much talk in this vein regarding the ivory-headed woodpecker or the Tasmanian tiger. These are classified as prematurely extinct species, as in we got it wrong declaring them extinct. Again, the existence of these creatures are not in doubt, only their extinction is questioned. Number 4 on our list is lingerlings, or species known from fossil records that may have survived much later into historical times than currently thought. This captures creatures who we know only from paleontology, but there may be evidence that they still exist. The most prominent cryptid on this list is the woolly mammoth. Let's call this one lingerling fossil species. Again, we know woolly mammoths were real, therefore a species, and we largely know them from fossils. But they're not only thought extinct, but very extinct, really only found in the fossil record. In the number 5 spot, and related to number 4, are species known from fossil records that died off millions of years ago, and yet may still be alive. Think of the movie King Kong, the remake where the island that time forgot, basically dinosaurs. Some claim they're still here. We'll call this one premature extinct fossil cryptid. Like our premature extinct species, these are creatures we thought were extinct but are not. They are only known from their fossil records. But after millions of years of evolution, they cannot actually be the species we know of from the fossils. So they seem to be cryptids. Number 6 is similar to our second group. That is a creature not found in the fossil record, but is related to an existing animal. So where our second group were unusual examples of existing species, this would be me-like relatives to an existing animal. For example, the Andean wolf. It's a wolf, but an entirely new species. Let's label this group evolved cryptids, similar to anomalous cryptids, but different in that there is no claim that these are representatives of an existing species, but a completely separate branch on the evolutionary tree, if closely related to an existing species. Seventh on our list are animals that have no analog currently existing nor in fossil records. Basically a brand new, unknown, new type of animal. This is where you would classify Bigfoot. Well, that may not be fair. Some have argued that Bigfoot is a fossil relative of Australopithecine robustus, so maybe instead think giant sea serpent. This group gets the label of novel cryptid. These are creatures with unknown analogs. They have their own branch on the aforementioned tree, but have no related existing species. Now, I'm not sure if the rest of the ones on our list were added merely to make the classification system more skeptical than it may really be, but let us push on. Category 8 is mythical animals, such as griffins and dragons, creatures with no zoological basis. We can simply call these mythic cryptids, I guess. Number 9 is a class of seemingly paranormal or supernatural entities with some animal-like characteristics. These are not so much species, but unique individuals, like Mothman, the Jersey Devil, maybe Dracula. Again, because of the woo-ness of this category, let us call them paranormal cryptids. 10th in line, and I'm not sure why this is a category in that it seems to be a class that should not be considered as real. So the last category is for known hoaxes and probable misidentifications. So this includes things like the jackalope or crocoduck, but it would also include things like brontosaurus. And we can close out this party by calling these ones what are, I would say, faux cryptids, to be generous to those who misidentify. Now those are the 10 categories that cryptid investigators use. Obviously this is not universal nor exhaustive, but it gives us sort of a frame of reference. Earlier I mentioned that there's also added 6 criteria that would disqualify an animal from its cryptid status. First of these is it could be disqualified as being insignificant. To quote, cryptids must be big, weird, dangerous, or significant to humans in some way. They must be controversial. That is, not only must you have someone making the claim such an organism exists, but there must be someone debunking that claim. Again, to quote, someone needs to observe a mysterious animal and someone else needs to discredit the sighting. Cryptozoologists function as an interventionist between witnesses and skeptics. The best one on this short list is that the creature cannot be erratic. That is, pythons in the Everglades is not a cryptid worthy because we know that these creatures, who are definitely outside their normal habitat, are not some sort of zoological mystery, but the result of people dumping their steaks when they get too big to handle. A creature can also be rejected if it's just an altered human. Think zombies. I guess this also means vampires cannot be a cryptid. Sorry, Dracula, that will omit you from number 10. Unless you think there are some sort of distinct species and not turned humans, then they're back to being cryptids. They also rule out angels and demons on the grounds that they're not animals, therefore not zooey enough for cryptologists. Leave those for the churches, I guess. And lastly, aliens are excluded. I'm unsure why. I mean, they are animals. They are not found in their native habitat. That said, they do make an exception on this. And again, I quote, unless such extraterrestrials arrived a long time ago and thus classify as residents. One last thing before we leave this area. We have been discussing the area of cryptozoology. There's also cryptobotany, which is the investigation of various exotic plants which are not believed to exist by the scientific community, but which exist in myth, literature, or unsubstantiated reports. So I may slip in the occasional mad-eating plant on occasion. So let us recap. We have misplaced species, real animals in the wrong place. Premature extinct species, animals thought recently to have gone extinct, but they still might be out there. Lingering fossil species, animals thought to be extinct a long time ago, but may still be around. All of these are known species, but something about them just seems somehow wrong. Then you have anomalous cryptids. These are exaggerated variants of known species. Premature extinct fossil cryptids, which are animals that have gone extinct millions of years ago, and yet some think are still around. Evolved cryptids are undiscovered branches of known species lines. Novel cryptids are a new species with no known relatives. Mythical cryptids are, well, animals of myth. Paranormal cryptids are usually unique individuals with superpowers. And faux cryptids are not cryptids or animals, but fakes or mistakes. Okay, now that we have the basics, let's focus our skeptic eye on the Kraken. Now, history is replete with stories of sea monsters. There is, however, one that is unusually consistent and tells of a multi-limbed sea creature with a central body that has grabbed seamen in their ships and dragged them below the waters to their doom. Sometimes as meals, other times it just seems to be motivated by pure spite. The term Kraken was first used by Carl Linnaeus in his book Systema Naturae, the book that gave birth to modern taxonomy. Linnaeus' book pivoted the nomenclature of animal names from a polynomial to the more familiar and concise binomial form we use now. So, and brace yourself on this one, Physalis, Anaris, Romosimius, Ramus, Anglius, Glibberish, Pholus, Denteno, Ceratus became Physalis Angulida. That said, in his work published in 1735, he described the creature simply by saying, quote, "It is said to inhabit the seas of the north, but I have not seen this animal." Of course, this leads to Norway, where the creature is called Hafuga. Norwegian legend describes it like this, quote, "Now I tell you there are two sea monsters. One is called Akufis, sea mist. Another, Lingbark, hearthback. The Lingbark is the largest whale in the world. But Hafuga is the hugest monster in the sea. It is the nature of this creature to swallow men and ships, and even whales and everything else within its reach. It stays submerged for days, then rears its head and nostrils above the surface, and stays that way at least until the change of tide." Similar legends can be found in Iceland as well. They all describe the Kraken to be the size of an island, that men often confuse the creature for landfall. In 1752, the Bishop of Bergen, Erik Ludvigsen Ponto Papadan, wrote The Natural History of Norway, where he described the Kraken as, quote, "incontestably the largest monster in the world, with a width of 1.5 miles. The bishop also noted that the animals had starfish-type protuberances. Quote, "It seems that there are creatures' arms, and it said if they were to lay hold of the largest man of war, they would pull it down to the bottom." Despite this, Ponto Papadan says that the most danger the Kraken represents to ships came from the disturbance it's made when it came to the surface, or whirlpools as created as it descended below. Because fish were attracted to the vicinity of the Kraken, he also noted Norwegian fishermen would often fish over the creature, despite the risks to their ship and lives. Later Kraken stories bring the creature down to a smaller, but still monstrous size, though earlier descriptions of the animal give a more crab-like appearance. By the 18th century, it started to show up in drawings as a giant, many-armed cephalopod, like an octopus or squid. In 1908, the French scientist Pierre Denis de Montfort stated in his book On the Natural History of Mollusks that the creature encountered by Norwegian sailors was the Kraken octopus. Montfort suggested that there was even a larger type of octopus than this, the Colossus octopus, that had been known to attack sailing vessels. He went on to claim that 10 British ships were destroyed by the Kraken in 1782. This turned out to be false, as the lone survivor gave a hurricane the credit for destroying the fleet. And as recently as 1930s, Kraken were claimed to have attacked fishing ships. That said, whenever a ship, quote, mysteriously disappeared, Kraken was one of the go-to explanations. Now, of course, that is its historical appeal. We, of course, know the Kraken better from Pirates of the Caribbean. In fact, the Kraken we think of today is by and large a 20th century creation. The Kraken has appeared in numerous movies and made more than one cameo on TV shows. It has even made it to Game of Thrones as the sigil of the House of Greyjoy, and even a blip on the Big Bang Theory. The likely accepted view is that the Kraken is a multi-tentacled creature with a body or a mantle. It is often portrayed interchangeably as a form of an octopus or squid. There is, however, a great disagreement over the size of the Kraken. So let's start our investigation. So let's first take a skeptical eye to the supposed creature. It could be classified into three or four of the cryptid categories we just discussed. Let's start off with mythic cryptid. This may be the category that the original tale of the Kraken fall into. These are creatures believed to be kilometers in length. And that, to put my skeptic hat on, seems to be impossible. Not that animals could not grow to be kilometers big in the ocean. One of the reasons the blue whale can achieve such a size is the support it gets from water. And side note, because of that absence of support, no such creature could actually exist on land. So blue whales are limited to the sea, never see one walking down the street. Well, now I feel the vibrations of a few of my listeners may already be speaking loudly into the radio. No, even in the water, a single creature cannot be a kilometer long, let alone several. There are physiological and physical constraints. That is why the blue whale, with the largest specimen being 33 meters, or a little over 100 feet, seems to be about the max level. The blue whale seems to have maxed out because the energy required to fuel its body and the actual concentrations of food sources have reached their limits. A creature kilometers long would quickly starve. So they might be premature extinct fossil cryptids or lingering fossil cryptids. However, after a little research, I find, much like the blue whale, the current crop of sea creatures outside their prehistoric brethren, be they squid or octopi. That, of course, leads us to place the Kraken into either anomalous cryptids or evolved cryptid category. I guess the distinction is to be made is that is the Kraken a member of an existing species, just writ large, or is it its own species? To answer that question, we need to get back to the issue of size. So we've ruled out Kraken the size of an island. Well, what about one that could take on a sailing ship? There have been a number of accounts of ships being attacked by Kraken and dragged under. Well, modern ships are way too big for a biological entity to attack. Cargo or cruise ships are well over 1,000 feet. However, when we go back in time, well, a lot of people don't realize that the ship that Columbus used was a little over 60 feet long. Early trawlers were about that same size, and even modern trawlers are only about 100 feet. A Kraken-type creature is mentioned in Moby Dick. Why? Well, one supposed target of the Kraken were whaling ships. Could this be a coincidence? It might also be their size. Classic whalers were about 80 feet. Modern ones, as I said, about 100 feet. Another possibility is their bait. What do I mean by bait? Well, it's been observed that one of the pieces of evidence for Kraken are scars found on sperm whales. So one might understand if a giant squid or octopus sees easy prey, it might have attacked early, hell, even modern whaling ships. That, of course, would be an assumption. One thing we examine in sperm whales is their guts. And what we find in the guts are a lot of beaks, and not from eating birds. Now, these are squid beaks, and as many as 18,000 have been found in the belly of the beast. So likely the tentacle scars found in sperm whales are not from narrow escapes from one mega squid or kraken, but the desperate attempts of some squid trying not to be the whale's next snack. So by and large, we must cast the quote evidence of kraken attacking ships as anecdotal at best and seafaring fantasy at worst. That said, there have been physical evidence of kraken in the form of tentacles found in ships' propellers, arms dragged up by fishing trawlers. And then, of course, there are the bodies. Over the past 200 years, and likely for the last thousands of years, giant squid bodies have washed ashore. Some of these bodies have a length in excess of 30 feet. So it seems, unlike a lot of cryptids, there is a sort of smoking gun. Now, it is a smoking gun and not firm evidence because until recently, these wash-ups have been greatly decayed. No samples were preserved, and contemporary reports seemed, well, exaggerated. One wash-up in Newfoundland claimed the Kraken weighed almost a ton and had a length of over 300 meters. The more corroborated size is about 200 to 300 kilos and a length of anywhere from 20 to 30 feet. Archituthis, or the giant squid, was first described in 1850. It was not until the 20th century that properly preserved specimens were secured to confirm that at least one possible Kraken was Archituthis. And the first video evidence of this Kraken was not recorded until 2012. But the story of Kraken does not end there. Not all of the evidence of Kraken can be accounted for by the giant squid. As far back as 1925, tentacles found in the stomach of sperm whales pointed to an even larger squid. This was supported when in the 1980s, a large squid, only 13 feet long, was determined to be a juvenile, and thus pointing to an even larger adult. In 2003, a complete subadult female was found with a length of 20 feet and a mantle, i.e. the body, of over 8 feet. It implied an adult would have a mass over 500 kilos, or about half a ton. Based on evidence from hooked and washed up bodies, it is estimated that the colossus squid was even larger than the giant squid, at a length of around 50 feet, almost twice that of the giant squid, but had a mass in excess of 1,600 pounds, or 750 kilos. So, it seems the cryptids might actually have been right on this one. With caveats, of course, historical cryptologists, if I may regressively place labels on people, Kraken the size of islands is false. Krakens that brought down ships seems at best implausible, I think impossible. But those who believe that there was a Kraken that could, at least in theory, take on a sperm whale, being about the same length, if not the same weight class, well, it seems that the appropriate cryptid classification should have been evolved cryptid, as in, it was a member of the squid family, but a completely separate species, and now having been elevated to, well, real species. Well, let us not be too prejudicial about the claims, and always, always follow the evidence where it will lead, and do not dismiss it because it doesn't coincide with your preconceived beliefs. That said, don't have a mind so open that there's a danger of your brain falling out. We're going to end this week's show on another inspirational bit of web wisdom. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
Good morning, John. A couple of weeks ago, Tumblr changed how it displays reblogs, and I did not like this because it was change, and I was frustrated. And then last week, I went to Yellowstone National Park, potentially the coolest place on Earth. It was the first national park ever created, and it's one of the most dangerous things on the planet. Not like to individuals traveling in the park, though that can be dangerous too. I mean to the whole world, really. Part of the reason Yellowstone is so interesting is that it is a very, very big volcano. Three times in the last 2 million years, the Yellowstone supervolcano has erupted, spewing out tens or even hundreds of cubic miles of debris, affecting global weather patterns and laying ash down as far away as Texas. Now, this isn't going to happen again anytime soon, but it will happen again someday, and when it happens, the park will basically be gone. But the remarkable thing is that it happened 600,000 years ago, and as you travel the park, you drive over the rim of the caldera formed in that eruption. And other than that, the desolation that eruption caused is pretty much invisible. Life just rushed back in to fill the void created by that massive event. The ground is a thing that doesn't move. If you're grounded, you're like a rock. People change, the things we make change, but the land remains the same, and yet it doesn't. In Yellowstone, more than anywhere, places do not stay the same. Geysers turn on and off, new springs eat through the ground. As the water cools, crystals are deposited, building into giant mounds, and the ground itself rises and falls in ripples and domes across the land as hot gas and magma surges beneath the surface. Everything constant is a lie, and my life continues to remind me of that. We want stability, but we can't have it, and that's both sad and wonderful. Now, we apply false stability to Yellowstone. Its most famous landmark, of course, is Old Faithful, a geyser that blasts every 70 minutes or so with remarkable regularity, but Old Faithful will one day cheat on us, and everyone knows that. Someday, all of the benches and lodges we built around it will just be a semicircle around a bunch of dry rocks. Here's New Blue Spring, now dormant and white, and this is Constant Geyser, so named because it never stopped spurting until it did. But Yellowstone has broken no contract with us. It makes no pretense of stability. It's honest in a way the rest of the earth and even life isn't. An honesty that reminds me that the inevitability of change, though it terrifies me, also excites me. That incurable illness that makes me always want to know what's next, to see the future where things are not like they are today. The future that will allow me to look back and miss what once was, that will scrub my present day of the dinginess and the crud until I only remember the brilliant sparkles and the deepest gashes. We're all standing on that cliff beyond which there is nothing.